This is the Human Action Podcast with your hosts, Jeff Deist and Dr. Bob Murphy.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is the Human Action Podcast, joined as always by my co-host and soon-to-be Florida man, Dr. Bob Murphy. How you doing, Bob?
I'm doing good, Jeff. Thanks.
Well, I know that moving, especially with little ones, is no fun, but nonetheless, you're moving to the apparently free-ish state of Florida when we consider everything in total. Our topic this week is Elon Musk and the Twitter kerfuffle, and in particular, maybe some of the economics behind it. I find it fascinating, for starters, that progressives freak out when they think that they're losing control of an institution in society. And this is a minor institution, but nonetheless a powerful one, a platform, a social media platform. That's first. And second, you know, I don't believe in this idea of free speech absolutism. There's free speech and there's controlled speech. Those are the two choices. So, you know, this idea that we can somehow moderate free speech, I think is completely wrong, completely nuts, and we ought to resist it.
Well, can you just elaborate? I'm wondering exactly what you mean by that. So can you, I'm sure some of the listeners too, do you mean like people saying to Elon, like, hey, you can't be an absolutist, we have to have limits on it?
Well, I think free speech absolutism has become a term that's in vogue. People are using it to suggest, well, you know, yes, of course, free speech is important, although they don't think it's important. But it's not absolute because, ha, 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 there's this Supreme Court case or whatever it might be. And that's just not true. There's no such thing as hate speech. There's no such thing as free speech absolutism. And when it comes to a platform, as far as I'm concerned, just like when it comes to a telephone or an email or whatever it is, it's not Elon Musk or anyone else's job to police or control what's said on that platform. So I don't think we ought to use the language of the left and ape this term free speech absolutism. I think what we're talking about is just free speech, which we supposedly have in the U.S. And also, there's a growing sense, I think, amongst progressives that free speech is just one good in society to be considered among many other competing goods. And we ought to shut it down as necessary when it's not being inclusive or whether when it's being harmful to a particular group. And I think this is the language of the conquerors, right? Free speech is for underdogs. Free speech is for losers. But once you're winning, and progressives certainly think they're winning, why should they allow people with whom they disagree to just be able to say whatever they want?
Right. And this, for, you know, for those who are into this stuff, like, you know, there's a famous essay on so-called repressive tolerance and things where, you know, many people on the hard left like openly admit in their strategizing that, yes, when we're in the minority view, like, yes, we'll say, hey, we're supposed to have freedom of association, freedom of speech, whatever. Yeah, give us a platform. And then once we take power, yeah, we'll deny it. Because why would you allow someone with hateful, bigoted views to spread his filth around? Like, they, you know, they just ask, why would you do that? So you're right. It's and I've seen some people on the right, you know, mentioning this to say, like, let's stop accusing them of hypocrisy. They're not hypocrites. They're openly admitting that, you know, we have one set of standards for us and one for you. And that's, we don't mean that. So people shouldn't be shocked. You know, the refrain of always saying, can you imagine if it was the other side and this happened? And then, right, you know, this is an example when people should stop being shocked by that. And you're right, Jeff, that the left, they cannot stand what's going on with Elon. Just, and you can see some of the commentary from some of the people, you know, over the blue check mark thing. And, you know, this was supposed to be reserved for, you know, responsible academics and journalists. And now it's just going to the highest bidder. And this completely cheapens it. And just some of their language that are really revealing just the elitism and how they thought they were this special class that not necessarily had a monopoly on truth. But hey, we're in the business of telling you what's right and what's wrong and what views are acceptable. And so this kind of blew the lid off of that.
Well, and also anonymity has been sought by commentators throughout American history. There were people who used pseudonyms published under false names in colonial times in the United States. So that's not new. People calling each other bad names in some sort of published format, that's not new in American history. But I want to touch base before maybe we get into some of the economics of this unholy deal, which Elon has struck, the idea of content neutrality. So we got to go back really to the Communications Decency Act of 1996. So a little background. That's not the worst piece of legislation. It had, at the time, some pretty libertarian impulses behind it. As a matter of fact, one of the big main co-sponsors of it was Congressman Chris Cox from Orange County, California. He later became chair of the SEC. He was a pretty libertarian-ish thinker. Ron Wyden of Oregon, the senator, was a pretty good civil libertarian. So the idea was that, hey, look, America has a bit of an economic advantage or head start in the software industry. This is providing a lot of good jobs. Remember, this is back in the 90s. And we ought not to strangle that in its infancy by subjecting various internet companies to potential lawsuits based on the content of what is hosted by those internet companies. So at the time, the 1990s, there's barely websites, there's barely the internet as we know it today, but there it exists. So when we think of internet companies in the 90s, we're thinking of like ISPs, like AOL. We're thinking of browser companies like Netscape and Alta Vista, you know, these old-fashioned companies. And we're thinking about the internet almost like we're thinking about a public utility like telephony or water and sewer. In other words, there's fiber optic cables and there's pipes and, you know, you're bringing information into someone's home. Things weren't as wireless then. So these companies are, they're kind of like a utility. They're kind of like the phone company. And so if two criminals get together and engaged in a conspiracy over the phone, nobody thinks that AT&T ought to be indicted as a co-conspirator, right? We understand that AT&T is hosting that telephone conversation in a neutral fashion. So was AOL Mail or whatever, Alta Vista or Netscape back in the day. And that's all well and good. So the section, infamous Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act basically said, hey, you shouldn't be able as a litigant to bring a suit against internet companies based on content, right? Like a defamation suit, for example. Now, okay, I think that's fine. I disagree with this federal legislation in that it attempts to preempt not only what you can bring in federal court, but what you can bring in state court. Now, I don't think under the Constitution, Congress has any authority whatsoever to decide what kind of cases can be heard or not heard in state court. So that's not so much a principle as more of a federalism strategy point, okay? But, you know, put that aside, the animating impulse behind Section 230 was a good one. But then you come along today, and we're finding out what Twitter execs were actually doing during the 2020 election. They were absolutely attempting to skew things pro-Biden. And you find out what kind of accounts are being squelched through the algorithm, what kind of people are being kicked off, what kind of people are being suspended or eliminated permanently. And you realize that not only Twitter, but Facebook and other companies are absolutely exercising editorial discretion. There's just no question about it, just like the New York Times does. So under defamation laws, yeah, you could sue the New York Times if they republish comments, defamatory comments by a third party, even though those aren't the New York Times reporter's comments. Nonetheless, as a publisher of those comments, New York Times can be sued under defamation law. Now, a lot of libertarians object to defamation conceptually, theoretically, that's fine. That's a separate question. But nonetheless, it's clear to me, anyway, that Twitter and Facebook and other social media platforms, and now increasingly, you know, banks, payment gateways, payment systems like PayPal. I mean, they're basically saying, we're kicking you off our service based on the content of what you're saying. That's editorial, folks. So the idea now that, well, Twitter's a private company, you can do what it wants, and it's not subject to the First Amendment. You know, all these things now, which libertarians have been aping for the past few years, are out the window because Elon bought it. And when I say out the window, I mean, they're serious threats. We have this Yahoo Finance report that the EU, officials from the EU just met with Elon the other day on Wednesday, and EU industry chief Thierry Breton, he threatened Musk on Wednesday that we're gonna ban Twitter. I don't know how they do that technically, you know, but we're going to ban Twitter in Europe unless he Musk, as head of Twitter, owner of Twitter, abides by EU regulatory rules on content moderation. I mean, that's pretty serious. That's real authoritarianism, Bob.
Yeah, so on that one in particular, I was listening to some NPR interview with I think it was like a U.S. law professor who was, you know, and clearly everybody hated Elon's guts in this discussion. And yeah, it was along the line. Well, there's, you know, in Europe, they have serious rules against hate speech online and things. And so, and you're right, the way it tied in was, it was sort of like Elon, you know, if it had just been, you know, anything goes, but since he was talking about, well, we're going to reinstate some accounts, you know, with a review process, like, so there, if he's admitting there is some judgment involved, then they were saying, okay, well, yes, if you're going to have some that pass through the filter and some that don't, then we're going to look at your filter and see if it matches what our regulations are. And so you can't say we had no idea because you're admitting you do review these things. And so now anybody that you reinstate, you know, you're sort of in a sense implicitly blessing is kind of like the, where they were coming from. So it is difficult. And I guess that is, you know, for the people at home, you know, that analogy you used, I think is good to help distinguish it. I guess if AT&T actually did let phone calls go through a brief filter and like they took out any naughty words or something, and so that there was a little bit of a lag on your end, and when you heard what the other person was saying, that anything that went through, they would be admitting was okay. You know, sort of like on the radio when there's, it's funny on some of these songs, the words they choose to bleep and the words they let fly, and I kind of wonder, well, how come this was okay but that one wasn't? So I think it's that principle here. So yeah, they're definitely using it, and with all this stuff, I don't believe them that these are the official reasons. Like, I don't think they actually care so much about hate speech per se. They don't like what Elon's doing with this. Just like there's plenty of hateful speech against white men last year on Twitter that I saw. And, you know, a lot of these radical feminists, for example, didn't even have to take the tweet down, you know, let alone did they get kicked off Twitter. So,
well, it's not hate speech. It's right wing speech, which they define as hate speech. Mm-hmm. But and they're obviously terrified of Trump. They're obviously terrified of Ron DeSantis. I don't think they need be, but that's a separate question. And look, I'll take Section 230. I personally don't want to repeal it. I would say it only applies to, I would amend it to say it only applies to federal courts and federal causes of action, that states can entertain whatever defamation cases they want against Twitter. But that's sort of a separate question. So I like Section 230, but let's be fair. The reason most Lulberts were busy saying, oh yeah, we got to keep Section 230 and it's a private company and this, that is because they're generally in agreement on all the big social cultural issues of our day with the kind of left progressives who tend to run social media companies. And so if you're, you know, no one's going to get kicked off Twitter for promoting open borders or, you know, promoting transgenderism or promoting anything or opposing nationalism or calling Trumpers fascists or that's, you know, we got to understand that's part of this impetus behind, you know, wow, we're, you know, Section 230 is such a noble thing. I mean, there's winners and losers with this, whether you say it's a private company or not. But none of this has to do with free speech absolutism. This has to do with, you know, does Elon Musk have the right to run his company as he sees fit? Well, he does. And by purchasing the company, let's not forget that he took an SEC publicly traded company and took it private, which means he is basically the sole owner along with a few co-investors. So that means no more SEC filings in the future. That means no more 10-Qs and 10-Ks. And so, I mean, obviously, we do have some information about the deal itself because when you buy an SEC company, there's a lot of disclosures required and process required. But theoretically, going forward, unless he wants to tell us, we're not necessarily going to know how Elon Musk is running the algorithms or anything else in Twitter in terms of whether it's suppressing or boosting certain users.
Well, and I think it is interesting, too. I'm sure you've seen it, Jeff, that, you know, him tweeting out, talking about, yeah, I got in here and the situation was worse than I realized, the things they were doing, you know, and he's deciding, I guess, whether to dribble that out to the public or not. So I guess there was more here than I had thought going into it. I was surprised by the legs this story had in terms of, OK, he took over Twitter, big deal, and just everyone's absolute freak out. first, the reason you're saying that, you know, they lost their platform where they kind of ran the show, and now that's threatened. But beyond that, too, to the extent that, yeah, if he does, if there are, you know, bodies that he's going to expose, I guess some people might be pretty terrified of that as well.
Yeah. Well, I just wonder how many Americans would be comfortable with, let's say, sort of the Rothbardian Walter Block conception of no defamation. You know, that simply wouldn't be a tort under libertarian law. And we would have a Wild West landscape where you could say just about anything on social media, maybe other than, like literally threatening someone's life or threatening physical harm. You could see maybe that crosses over. But I mean, in terms of swear words, in terms of calling people horrific names, racist, anti-Semitic stuff, whatever it might be, just an absolute Wild West, and let the chips fall where they may, and that the harms that come from that, such as they are, ought not to be actionable at law. And so, you know, the greater goal of a free and open society and open debate of issues is more important and overrides any of the, you know, the hurt feelings or whatever that would come from just pure Wild West. I think most Americans would reject that, quite frankly.
Right. So just to make sure the listeners have heard that case. So in terms of like a principled property rights approach, the one strand of thought which you're alluding to says you don't own your reputation, right? Like the esteem with which others hold me, that's not a piece of property that I can have. So if someone breaks into my store and throws gasoline and lights on fire, that's one thing. But if someone just goes around town saying, oh, yeah, I bought a product from that guy's store and it didn't work, mm-hmm. even if they're lying, some hardline libertarians will say that's not a crime. Like you could say the guy's a jerk. You could say he's immoral, a sinner, but that's not a criminal activity. He's just vibrating his vocal cords. You know, he's not interfering with your physical property. You don't have a right to the continued patronage of the people in town. And if they fall for this guy's lies, who's falsely saying, you know, your products didn't work. So again, it depends. You know, some of them it gets more into a gray area than like, what's the difference between, you know, outright fraud? Like if a store's advertising, this is 10 kilograms of water and it's only 9, a lot of libertarians say that's aggression. You're lying. So, mm-hmm. So that's kind of where it comes down to. But basically, yes, to say, if you just go around making up rumors about somebody and saying, you know, I saw him cheating on his wife and you actually didn't, that's some libertarians would say that shouldn't be a crime. And so then, yeah, in this context, but having said that, I mean, you can have a restaurant and just the restaurant could have a policy. You can't swear at the guy eating dinner next to you. You know what I mean? So it's not that we're going to call the cops and say he broke the law per se. It's that, no, we have a policy here as to how diners are behaving right in this private property. So it does get admittedly tricky. Like, how do you translate those principles to something ephemeral, online Twitter?
But also, how do you translate them to a increasingly digital world? Rothbard, I mean, his biggest summation of this is Ethics of Liberty, which came out in the 70s, or I'm sorry, early 80s, but was mostly written in the 70s. So you say that's obviously pre-internet, pre-digital era. And under the Rothbardian idea, you know, let's say some guy punches me in the face in a bar and, you know, it's a glancing blow. It hurts. I'm embarrassed. My feelings are hurt. The next day I'm a little sore, but that's the end of it. Now, clearly, under Rothbard law, that's a physical invasion. I can go sue the guy. So mm-hmm. in Rothbard land, there's not really such thing as crimes versus torts. That's all one thing together. And I can maybe get some money damages or something from him. But if that same guy happens to have a 10 million Twitter following and he goes out and tweets something terrible about me mm-hmm. that's false and defamatory, and as a result, I lose my job, I lose my friends, I lose my wife and family, I'm out a bunch of income, you know, I have no recourse whatsoever against him because I didn't have a property interest in my reputation or family or future income or friends. I don't own any of those things. So, you know, that's, I think to a lot of people, that's pretty unsatisfying as a result, right? I mean, that's a bad result from a Rothbardian legal take.
Right. So that's why some people just flat out say, that's why I'm not a libertarian. Other yeah. people say, oh, well, you can't just reason, you know, do armchair logic like this. So in other words, some people who call themselves libertarians would just say, I don't go with Rothbard there, that, you know, he's kind of shooting from the hip and taking a few principles and extrapolating. You need case law and you know, it's a spontaneous process by which the legal system finds what the principles are. So there's that element too. So on that one, yeah, you would have to come up with, I think, some plausible, you know, alternative principle, like legal principle involved. Just to give a quick example analogy. So there's things like if, you know, some 5-year-old kid wants to, you know, go with the guy in the van, you know, how can the parents stop him? And certain principles of libertarianism would seem to allow that. Whereas I would say, no, legally, like, you can't give informed consent if you don't, you know, if you don't understand the ramifications. So that's how I would handle that stuff. So I would not be afraid of saying, no, I can be libertarian on those principles, and just say, but make sure you have all the right principles under the umbrella before you start applying them to a specific case. So there might be, with the examples you're saying, some other principle from the common law that involves to help, you know, mitigate that outcome. But you're right. Most people are going to say, if that's what can happen under your system, then I don't like that system.
Right. Well, I mean, most people, most judges, most people view things from a results perspective, not a process perspective. And we can understand that. I will say that apparently Musk has fired a significant portion of the staff at Twitter, including engineers. So he's really cutting on the cost side. On the income side, yes, he's lost a lot of big advertisers, at least for the moment. That sort of remains to be seen whether some of these more left-wing or liberal accounts will come back because they want the network effects or whatever it might be, or whether some of these advertisers will come back. But at the moment, it looks like they're not just cutting costs, but they're also losing income. But look, even when they had all those liberal advertisers or normie, you know, Fortune 500 type company advertisers, they were still losing money. I mean, let's start with that. We can look at their 2021 SEC filings. They lost almost $500 million as a net operating loss in that year. So this is already a company that was in some trouble. They were only generating, okay, about $5 billion in revenue. Now, they were still losing money, but So they're making $5 billion roughly in revenue in 2021. Elon comes along, pays $44 billion. So that's almost nine times. Okay. Normally in the M&A market, you're looking at, you know, an expensive purchase is, you know, 6, 7, 8, maybe 10 times earnings, not revenue. Okay. So he's paying nine times revenue for this company. So first and foremost, I mean, that's crazy. Those are crazy numbers. Now he's supposedly on paper between SpaceX, Tesla, and otherwise worth about $222 billion. So you say, well, okay, he can afford that $44 billion. But of course, on several occasions prior to this acquisition, he had sold Tesla stock to raise equity funds to buy the company. So he had sold a fair amount of his own Tesla stock, for starters, to come up with that $44 billion. But he also, unbeknownst to some people, you know, he had some other equity investors. He had Saudi Prince, Bin Talin, he had Larry Ellison, who's famous from Oracle. So they kicked in several billion dollars themselves. So obviously they're believers in Elon's ability to turn this thing around. And then, of course, you know, he also went out and borrowed about $13 billion in the credit markets. And this was from like Morgan Stanley and B of A. And he did a little digging. You know, technically, Twitter borrowed that money, but given these losses, you know, what is the collateral of Twitter stock, or you know, I mean, which is now a private company? I mean, that's not what they were. What the real collateral for these lenders of $13 billion? The real collateral is his Tesla stock, which has, of course, had a relentless fall throughout the year, even before this deal. But now it's down below $200, which was this sort of a psychological threshold for a lot of investors. And he's paying almost 5%. The SOFR, the secured overnight financing rate, plus X on a lot of this $13 billion, which he basically, on behalf of Twitter, borrowed from Morgan Stanley and B of A. I'm told that some other equity investors like Apollo and Sixth Street ultimately chose to drop out of the deal. So that's probably not a good sign. I'm also told that B of A and Morgan Stanley are getting offers already on the debt, which they'd kind of like to unload now that Elon has become a pariah, at least in progressive circles, when they're getting offers of like 60 cents on the dollar. So that doesn't bode well for Elon. But maybe the scariest part of it is to the extent that some of this $13 billion is a so-called margin loan, which means there could be a margin call if the value of his collateral, namely Tesla stock, drops below a certain ratio with respect to the loaned amount, right? If that 13, if Tesla stock drops to a certain number, then, you know, and that $13 billion reaches X percentage of what was used as collateral, then they could theoretically call the loans. And that would basically bankrupt Twitter instantly, because Twitter doesn't have $13 billion laying around. It apparently has about $2 to $3 billion laying around, which is, for the moment, enough to service that $13 billion in debt. But, I mean, he's in a turnaround situation here with this company. That's what people don't realize, is we see Twitter as this social media platform where we all ought to get a say, and it's like the town square, it's like the speaker's corner at Hyde Park in London, and it's all this and that. But as a company, you know, the actual, as a financial going concern, this was a distressed company. This was a turnaround. And why it had all these, social justice warriors spending all day figuring out who to ban. Well, in the meantime, they're hemorrhaging money and losing money. I mean, this is a turnaround situation. So Elon, you know, this is no joke for Elon. He could absolutely lose a significant portion of his net worth here. But more importantly, is it could turn a lot of progressives against Tesla. They're the biggest buyers of Tesla automobiles and Tesla stock because they all live in Seattle or DC or LA or San Francisco. You know, it's not a heartland car like the Ford F-150 is, let's say. And so also lots of other EV companies have started to catch up to Tesla in coolness factor, you know, in engineering. So this is a pretty fraught time. And you know, I don't know much about Elon Musk. It's total BS that he's some right winger. That's just not true. I mean, we can tell from his statements, his public statements, that that is not true. But what I do think is that he really did buy this company out of a sense of, you know, correcting its excesses and making it a true public platform. He didn't buy it to make money, because if he did, he was absolutely crazy.
Well, amidst all that commentary there, Jeff, do you know why he offered so much for it? Was it because they would have held him in such distaste that he needed to give them that sweet of a deal?
I mean, look, he was already a 9% owner, so he was already, you know, had an important stake. But more importantly, look, this was a publicly traded company. They could have sold it to someone else. They could have not, you know, the shareholders could have decided not to sell it to Musk at all. Even, I think he offered $54 per share, if I recall. So, you know what? All the big shots in Silicon Valley could have gotten together and bought it themselves. Or all those Twitter managers who are making $300,000 a year, and, you know, some of them were making millions a year, they could have gone out and found all kinds of investors. They could have borrowed money themselves. They could have, turned it into an ESOP. There's lots of people could have bought Twitter. So for all this friction over Elon, you know, he's the one who stepped up and collateralized his own personal net worth stock against this dog of a company, at least at present. So, you know, I don't want to hear it. Anybody who doesn't like Elon buying Twitter should have bought it themselves.
Well, I did mention at the time when it happened that it was funny that going into it, you know, for years, people were complaining about the bias on Twitter and Facebook and blah, blah, blah. And the solution was always, you know, well, go start your own social media company. And then, you know, some people say, OK, we will. Or people would say, come on, that's not realistic. We need to, you know, amend Section 230 or whatever the argument was. I never heard anybody saying, why don't we just raise money and buy it and change the rules? And so it was just interesting to me that when Elon proposed that, all of a sudden, like, that's just in my circles, at least, that hadn't even occurred to anybody that you could just go do that. And it's kind of interesting.
Well, I mean, there's a couple of schools of thinking on this. One is characterized by people like Peter Klein, our own senior fellow, who says, look, you know, these dominant companies, you think because of the network effects, nobody can really compete with Twitter. History shows otherwise. If you go back 10 or 15 or 20 or 50 years ago, a lot of the dominant companies, dominant players in the industry are today gone. Bankrupt, you know, don't exist anymore. MySpace is the famous example in the social media sphere. But even, you know, I mean, even really big, powerful manufacturing companies like Sony. I mean, you go back to the 1990s, Sony was a dominant company. They were making 500-year plans in their internal management, which is a very Japanese thing, you know, this sort of really super long-term view. And look at them now. They are a minor side player because Koreans and others came along and just ate their lunch when it came to TVs, and then they got behind the curve on personal devices, you know, laptops and mobile devices, which they didn't, you know, realize were the future. So, you know, so I do agree with Peter Klein. I don't think we need to treat Twitter. I don't think we need to change our libertarian view of monopoly and antitrust because the new digital reality just somehow has changed the landscape such that nobody can meaningfully compete. I don't think that's true. And I also wouldn't go so far as to say that Twitter ought to be regulated like a public utility, like the sewer and water in your town, for example, or the electric company in your town. You know, those are generally monopolies in most cities. But what the flip side of that is that they have to deal with a lot of both your local, state, and federal regulatory regime. That's sort of the price you pay for being the monopoly provider of electricity, for example. You know, obviously, we don't like that framework. We'd like to see competition. And you know, it's easy to argue, well, yeah, but because there's all these pipes in the neighborhood, it just lends itself to a natural monopoly. You know, I don't think that the internet or digital age changes any of that. What I do think it changes, though, is our conception of harm from that aforementioned Rothbardian idea of tort and criminal law. Because and Stephen Kinsella writes about this as well. You know, the idea that, well, you should only be able to bring a cause of action for actual physical invasion or fraud, like pollution or a punch to the face, or, you know, someone lying about how many ounces are in your can of Coke. But nothing, all kinds of things can be harmful but not actionable, like, you know, calling someone a pedophile on Twitter. You know, I do think that some of that needs to be rethought in the libertarian landscape. And I think that we don't, you know, as you mentioned, we can use common law to fill in the gaps here, which is perfectly libertarian. We don't need to come up with, you know, brand new government regulatory powers. I certainly don't want to see a new federal regulatory regime as a response to Twitter, whether it's Musk's Twitter or not. I don't want to see that. But, you know, maybe if nothing else, it ought to make us rethink our facile one size fits all answers to certain problems. Like, oh, just privatize it. You know, not always so easy.
Yeah, well, I guess one thing that occurs to me is in the lectures that I give at Mises U every year, Jeff, you know, on private law and how that would work. I mean, the fundamental building block is that, oh, two people have a dispute, they can't settle it themselves. And so there's an interest in having the community know that you didn't just say, well, I just shot the guy because I was in the right. Mm-hmm. That, you know, you hand your case over to a third party who's got a reputation for excellence and fairness in this particular niche area of the law. And so, yeah, at that broad level of analysis, there's nothing that would stop judges from saying, oh, yeah, you spread malicious rumors about this person that got him fired and his wife left him, whatever. And you said horrific things that aren't true. And we have proof that it's not true. Yeah, you owe him 300,000 ounces of gold, or less than that. Mm-hmm. 30 ounces of gold, let's say. And, you know, that it's not obvious to me that that would be unlibertarian. He's just rendering his opinion. You know what I mean? And then the community could say, well, if you don't pay that, then we're not going to give you a job. We're not going to let you onto our property, right? So there's lots of mechanisms in place that it doesn't actually have to be that we spin out, the whole body of libertarian law, you know, just off of first principles, that in practice it would get instantiated by judges making rulings where they're just rendering their opinion on a particular case. So that's one way it could work. But again, to make it for people to want to know, I want to take our case to this judge, there would have to be some rhyme or reason to what the person was going to say. So yeah, he'd want to tie it to well-established principles that the community endorsed and, you know, had precedent in case law and things like that. So that's how a lot of the things we care about growing up in, you know, the West, that's where that stuff would come through, even in, you know, ANCAP land. But yes, in principle, they could allow for harms of the sort you're talking about.
But at the moment, I think the most realistic possibility for this would be in state courts, right? You could see a state under a particular governor, especially under a particular legislature, especially wanting to craft its own legislation, you know, to have help its own citizens deal with something like deplatforming. You know, say, hey, if you want to operate a business in this state, if you want to have a registered bank in the state, whatever, you know, you can't, you know, not also make your services available to a gun manufacturer, right? We're not going to let you do that in our state. I mean, it seems to me that that's the only realistic opportunity currently to move us anywhere closer to, you know, choice in law or a privatized law system. I mean, look, if you go read the mainstream media right now on Musk, I mean, it is so biased. They're all writing articles about, oh my gosh, he's caused complete chaos. Twitter's in free fall. All their advertisers are leaving. And then they get these tutting, like they interview these business school profs who couldn't do they couldn't do a lemonade stand to Elon Musk's empire. You know, saying, well, this is what happens when you just come in and think you know everything and you can fire all these employees willy-nilly. This is really bad. It sends a bad message. And, you know, the markets are clearly in agreement. This, that, you know, it's like, I mean, the knives are out for this guy. And I think there is an enormous vested interest in corporate America and the left in this country to destroy Tesla's value now and to hurt him, to make him look like a fool, to make him suffer a big financial loss, to go after Tesla. I mean, these people politicize everything, you know, including whether or not they sell their Tesla. So this kind of sick politicization makes me think that either Elon's in big trouble or he's going to have to do something really weaselly in the near future to talk about his new moderation rules.
Well, he already did say something that, you know, was a bit disappointing. I thought it was like 2 weeks ago or something, where he came out and said like he had this review board for who was going to get reinstated, something like that. And then and the people on the board were not, you know, groups that necessarily I would have wanted.
Well, let's
get
the Atlantic Council right on that, Elon. We God knows we need their leadership now.
So, yeah, it's I guess he is sort of running against the clock. And I think the elements he would outline there, I haven't seen that stuff stressed before about the fact that, you know, well, those loans. So, yeah, I've seen a lot of people saying I'm going to sell my Tesla, or gee, I'm not buying Tesla ever again. Who's with me? And I think that was more just, them stating their principles, not realizing that, well, yeah, if they actually could tank Tesla sales, then that could indirectly lead to a margin call on that loan.
Yeah. Now, in theory, I mean, short of an unbelievably diminution in his personal net worth, which is still $200 billion, I mean, in theory, Elon can personally satisfy $13 billion in a margin call. Even if Twitter assets were insufficient to cover that. I don't know how it's structured, whether he could personally be on the hook or not. But, it really is something. And I think you will see him, at least on some part, roll over. Because otherwise, I mean, you've already seen this. You've already seen the Rob Reiners of the world and the Stephen Kings of the world. You know, I mean, they're calling him a racist and anti-Semite. Mm-hmm. Because all of a sudden there's crazy accounts on Twitter, usually Anons, by the way, you know, saying certain words or certain things. I mean, that is like a kindergarten level view of free speech. I mean, that's just absolutely insane. That, and it shows you the mania that of the progressive left. There's no such thing as moderate. There's no such thing. You know, you're us or you're not us. Those are the two choices. And so not us, the term for that is far right. Mm-hmm. Right. You see that over and over. Far right. Tim Pool, far right podcaster, far right Twitter owner, Elon Musk. I mean, come on. They're not even trying. This is not an exercise at conveying information. This is not an exercise in trying to create understanding in society. This is an exercise in demonization and browbeating and vanquishing. And they're pretty open about it. I mean, this, what they're going to do to Musk, I think, is a cautionary tale for all of corporate America, because a lot of people in our circles like to say, well, you know, look, all this craziness, ESG and woke, it'll work itself out because those companies just won't be as profitable. And at the end of the day, people don't want to lose money, or they don't want to make 10% on the investment if they can make 12, you know, whatever it might be. I'm not so sure about that. I mean, when you get regulatory capture in companies that are in a good position as a result of that, or even when they're just in a good position because they're, you know, market leaders like Apple or Google, I mean, they have enough cash to spend an awful lot of money on nonsensical HR stuff. And beyond that, I mean, you can look at the former Soviet Union and say, well, that can never work. And it couldn't, but it still lasted 70, 80 years and ruined millions upon millions of lives. So this idea that woke, you know, this kind of woke pressure that's going to be applied to Elon Musk, well, this is silly because Elon will, you know, he'll make the platform work. I'm not so sure about that. I think we're in a very fraught time.
Right. Yeah. It's not clear to me whether they're going to pull through it or not, just, you know, for the reasons you're saying. I will just mention this when I say it officially, that I don't want to see all the progressives leave Twitter, because most of the fun I get is logging in and seeing some nut job take, you know, especially from a blue check mark. Like that makes right. it even better if it's not some random account. So I personally wouldn't want to see all those people go. And it is interesting. You would have thought from their perspective, like, you know, don't you guys get some, it seems like your whole, you know, reason for being is because of the evil far right and the other hatred and bigotry. Don't you like to see that, to remind yourself these people really do exist?
Yeah, they would not, they need MAGA Twitter. I mean, there's no right. question. They need MAGA Twitter. It's just, that's the whole point. The whole point of Twitter is that you're sort of rolling up your sleeves and you're wading out into public, you know, mm-hmm. and it's like a melee outside of a football match or something, you know, and that's the whole point of it. And to be fair, I do think it rewards impulsive, angry, off the cuff remarks that are not well thought out. I suspect its algorithms, in fact, reward that, but certainly those kinds of remarks get more engagement. And we know the algorithms reward engagement. So there is an incentive to be a jerk, right? I mean, there's an incentive right. to be combative. And so in that sense, Twitter's only use is as this sort of childish venting exercise. But, I don't think that's all it has to be. I've certainly found out about people through Twitter, you know, whom I would never have known about otherwise, writers, thinkers, etc., that just don't have the old mainstream platforms of traditional media or a particular university sinecure or whatever. I think it's Twitter's been part of citizen journalism. I think, you know, we're often mm-hmm. like that Buffalo snowstorm a couple weeks ago. Twitter and YouTube had all kinds of live on the spot, basically citizen reporting. Oh my gosh, look at these 10-foot drifts. And they were doing a much better job than the national or even local Buffalo media of actually showing you what was happening. I mean, much better. So I don't think Twitter has to be a cesspool only, but I'm certainly willing to wade through the cesspool and would prefer that to any sort of regime that Musk or worse yet, government will come up with, because I think that it's going to be arbitrary.
Oh, obviously. And, you know, we see that with, as you say, what they were doing with the Hunter Biden story. I know that's a popular one to bring, but I mean, that really did happen, you know, and so that they weren't getting in trouble for that. So it's clear that they have their agenda and, you know, what they call misinformation. See, that's the thing. It would be one thing if they really did just exclude, you know, people who were literally using, you know, racial slurs and stuff, but then allowed for. But no, like you said, Jeff, to them, somebody who disagreed with, you know, mandatory vaccines, that person was spreading disinformation. You know, like that mm-hmm. was a harmful person that needed to be excluded from the mm-hmm. conversation. And so you see it reflected when they just report, just in general, I'm talking about not just on Twitter, but when the media reports And they'll, like you kind of alluded to it, when they'll say, like, two economists will give a story, like a commentary on the minimum wage, and they'll say, so-and-so from Harvard and so-and-so, a libertarian economist from George Mason. Like, they'll let you know, oh, this person, you don't need to take what he's saying seriously because it's ideological. Whereas the person from the Kennedy's, you know, school of government is not pro-government. Just, you know what I mean? They just happen to go
title. You'll never see far-left economist in the headline of the New York Times. But let's say even if you could, and there's too many users, there's too many tweets for any of this to be dealt with by humans, right? At some level, there's going to have to be a machine, an AI figuring this out. So even if you were to simply forbid certain words, like the N word, you could do that, I think, technically speaking, you know, just to eliminate any tweet that had that word in it. But then it goes to, what if someone was quoting Mark Twain? Right. Or what if it was a black guy saying, hey, I was just at the, you know, whatever football game and some guy called me N-word. You know what I mean? It's like it's not so simple. It's not so simple to implement a policy like that.
Yeah. Have you ever had it happen to you, Jeff, where I responded to someone and it cut and said, most people don't write something so aggressive. Are you sure? It didn't have the N-word, folks, just to be clear. I'm talking about, I was being like a doing sarcastic thing and it looked like I was threatening a guy. I really wasn't. I was making like a dumb dad joke, but I could see how it was just funny the way the words played out that the algorithm thought I was going to threaten the guy when I wasn't. But it sort of like gave me a chance to cool down.
Yeah.
So yeah, they do have techniques like that in place. Yeah. And I guess, I mean, with all this stuff, I think I've mentioned this before. When I had my own personal blog in the beginning, I said I wasn't going to moderate the content, but then there were people coming just saying really nasty stuff that made others not want to be there. And then it was tricky because it's like, well, if I zap those comments, does that mean I'm agreeing wholeheartedly with everything else that I let slip through, even though other stuff, it's like, yeah, I'm not really thrilled about this, but I'm not going to delete it. And so it's tough when you get into these situations, and I don't have a great answer for Elon or anybody else.
Well, I think we have to leave it with, for all this discussion, it's not my place to tell Elon what to do. You know, He literally bought it. It's his money. And if he doesn't want to have the woke mob destroy the value of his new shiny purchase, you know, it's easy for me to criticize him if he caves. But, I don't have $44 billion to buy a company. So that's one. But I think more broadly, if America is going to survive in its current form, we got to get over politicizing everything. I mean, this will be the death of us. And it's a sickness. It's a real illness where you have to view, what kind of social media platform you use or what kind of car you drive in political terms. Nothing good can come of that. And, Bob and I both have kids. We don't want them growing up in that kind of world. So my advice is, let's all leave Elon Musk alone. So, Bob, good luck with your upcoming move. And ladies and gentlemen, stay with us. We'll be back next week with another episode of the Human Action Podcast.
Check back next week for a new episode of the Human Action Podcast. And in the meantime, you can find more content like this at Mises.org.